And at this time, the continuing saga of the TechNet. This is TechNet number 1586. I got the number right. Started in September of 1982. You'll also be hearing tonight Space Report from Paul, WS2N. Space Report number 179. And some nice, interesting launches took place this week, so we're going to be hearing about those. Let me drop. The TechNet is a gathering of the clan of amateurs that are curious, interested about radio equipment, and how to make it work better, how to understand it. I think it's going to be a little bit different tonight. I've got a very interesting letter, which I want to address first, and I want to then go to a report from Roger, K2JAS, who asked a very provocative question that once answered gives a very educational process. After that, we'll take check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment tonight. The usual schedule is loosely formed. Sometimes Barry, the deal gets out, because after the first hour, we take check-ins, and the order in which they check in, people who do have a question or a comment, we address those, and these are generally ham radio questions, although occasionally we get into astronomy and space hardware. Let me drop. That's approximately 1 hour. There are times when it is going for 2 hours because people got very excited about some particular subject, and I decided to go with the flow. When it comes to questions that are asked on the TechNet, please remember there is no such thing as a dumb question. A dumb question, from my point of view, represents the biggest gap between what the person knows and what he would like to know. To sort of reject his question because it's a dumb-sounding question is doing the opposite of what should be done, from my point of view. So don't worry about your question being too simple or too dumb from somebody else's point of view. When it comes to radio, there's an awful lot to it that doesn't first meet the eye. The schools do a mediocre job of teaching the science of wireless techniques. They do a particularly poor job, from my point of view, of teaching antenna engineering. And all this wireless equipment would be relatively useless without a good antenna on both the transmitting end and the receiving end. So arguably the antenna is one of the most important portions, and that portion is not very well covered in most of the schools that I know of. Let me drop. So after that first hour or so, we go over to John, KC2WGB, who handles the mailbag, where people who don't yet have their ham license or the right equipment to talk to us directly, they send him a message, and John passes them on to us. John also monitors the Echo Link, so if we're too quick on the key and people can't sign in by way of Echo Link, John knows about it. And there are people who actually submit questions to the TechNet by way of Echo Link, and John manages to read them off his screen. Let me drop. So after the question section for the first hour in John's mailbag, we then go over to Paul, WS2N, our space expert, who tells us the latest on what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration is doing, and the European Space Agency, and the, European Southern Observatory, ESO, down in Chile, among other places that are interested, that are involved in the space research, astronomy research. And astronomy really covers the field of DC to light, literally, DC to gamma ray, DC to cosmic ray. All the spectrum there is could be called astronomy if you use the right kind of equipment. After that, if there's any time left over, we go into other subjects. Now, the subject I want to address tonight is something that I didn't realize has been bothering me for years. And somebody sent me a letter that made it clear as to what's been going on. Made it clearer. Let me drop it. And let me give you a little bit of history from my point of view. When I first cut my teeth in the business of radio and electronics, back in the late 60s, early 70s, the Cadillac and test equipment in those days was the Hewlett-Packard company. If you had a Hewlett-Packard signal generator, distortion analyzer, and whatever, audio oscillator, and many other instruments that they made. Eventually, they made things called vector network analyzers. They produced an extremely good piece of equipment in its day with an extremely good manual where you fold out the various pages of that manual and you could do easily troubleshooting on that particular piece of equipment. Unfortunately, later on, for cost reasons, they went to an outside vendor we started making the manuals from them, and you suddenly started seeing a decrease in the quality of the manuals. Okay. When it comes to computing equipment, we all know people who are very skilled at computers and networking, and they can tickle the keyboard and make the machine do almost anything. I'm not one of those people. Let me drop. So when it comes to modern day ham radio equipment that we buy, one of the important factors you want to know about is it user friendly? Is it easy to program into its memories? The transmit frequency, the receive frequency for a repeater with the PL tones and whatever, and the proper offsets. And some of our modern day radios will cover very wide frequency regions, 160 meters up to 450 megacycles in one particular radio. That's the good news. But I can tell that many of these radios are doing a rather poor job of creating a manual that's easily understood in English and is user-friendly. It was Augie, Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Echo Golf, who wrote me a letter this week that struck home. I suddenly realized that I'm not much of a computer maven. Thank goodness there's somebody in my house that maintains the computers. But when it comes to computer interfacing, like, for instance, I don't yet own a software-defined radio. There are people who just love computers, and the combination of those with radios, they dig in and have a grand old time. I happen to not be one of those. I put my emphasis on another syllable, as you say. In other words, I've put my interest into the actual radio equipment itself, the analog and or digital radio equipment, but mostly analog. Transmission lines, antennas, transmitters, receivers, receiver threshold, signal-to-noise ratio, noise figure, propagation characteristics, range. Those are the things that interested me most. And so I set up antennas and towers to pursue that particular interest of mine. Let me drop it. Now, when it comes to the radio equipment I own, I'm in the dark ages. I'm using relatively old pieces of equipment for two reasons. One, I think I have the ability to fix most things, so buying a used piece of equipment and maintaining it, to me, is relatively easy. And the older pieces of equipment are relatively easy to use. You use a handy talkie like the IC2AT, for instance, which was, I think, created in the mid-80s, 1980s. And that is arguably the most reproduced piece of electronics on planet Earth, where at one time there were 2.5 million of them in service. That's got a simple thumb wheel switch on top for you to program in the frequencies. And so, very easy rig to use. Some of my modern day equipment, let me drop it. Some of our modern day equipment, they have menu after menu. In other words, in order to set the squelch, you might have to go two menus down if you know how to address those menus. And you know the vocabulary that the menu wants you to talk to it, the syntax, so to speak, which buttons you press, how long you hold that button, do you press the button in sequence, and whatever, in order to get those particular functions. The manual, in theory, is supposed to tell you that. What Augie brought to our attention is that he owns a brand new FT-897 Delta, and the manual on it, I can sense from what Augie has said, is really lacking. And so, I'm looking for you guys to give me some information as to when it comes to pieces of equipment that are very difficult to address, very difficult to program, whether you're doing it by way of a cable into a computer or whether you're doing it by way of the front panel. What's your favorite way of doing it? A good buddy of mine, Kent, W5EJP, who lives in Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, he happens to own a Yaesu 897D. He owns a Yaesu 817. And I asked him, how difficult was it for you to learn how to program into the memories the all the local repeaters that you've got in your neighborhood? Let me drop. Kent is not unique. He has owned those two radios for a couple of years. He has never programmed those radios. He uses it in the simplex mode. He's driving around with his automobile, and he talks to his buddies directly. He doesn't go through repeaters, so he's never going through the programming process. One of the things that Kent does do, though, is he goes almost every year for the last 20 years or so to Dayton Hamvention. There was a guy at Dayton for quite a few years selling these little cheat sheets, I'm going to call them, crib sheets. In other words, he sells you this plastic-covered piece of paper that folds up twice so that it can fit into your wallet, it's a little bit larger than a business card. But on those 8 pages is all of the key information for a particular rig. And so if you want to know how to program an 817, an 897, for instance, you buy the appropriate piece of paper from him, and all the missing information that's not in the owner's manual apparently is there. An awful lot of people are very happy with this guy. And how do you find him? Let me drop it. From what I'm told, if you go to the website of www.mrhamradio, MR stands for Mr. MrHamRadio.com. MrHamRadio.com. No punctuation between all those words. And Mr. is abbreviated MR. MrHamRadio.com. You go there, and if you can find the right portion of his webpage, I'm told, you can find out how to buy one of these crib sheets for your particular radio, which gives you a lot of information. But I'll bet you guys have found other solutions. Many of you guys own some of these modern-day radios that have got these menus after menus, if you know what I mean. Sometimes you got to go 2, 3, 4 menus deep in order to get the particular function you're looking for. How have you guys solved that problem? When it comes to a modern-day radio where the manufacturer has done a poor job of giving you the useful information, how have you guys gotten around it? Please give me your call with us if you've got any kind of information along these lines. K2LAW listening.
2AJ.
Eric recognized. And out of curiosity, is there anyone else?
2AO.
Rich recognized. Anyone else? Okay, here's two guys that have used an awful lot of radios. Eric, how have you found that problem? Where some of these radios, they give you half the information you need, and the information is Japanese English. So how have you solved it? KE2EJ, our broadcast expert from the local area, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Don't forget that I dabble in programming, too. One thing that I really have to say that you have to put in your mind, especially with Yaesu and ICOM, and even Kenwood to a degree, they have a methodology. If you've learned one radio, it really carries over to the other. This business about multi-layered menu is usually very specific, right? But with the Yaesu radios, the methodology in storing instead of storing a memory location of, say, a repeater is relatively the same amongst all the radios, from the 857, 47, the 756, even going back to the 767. The methodology of going to a VFO, getting to a VFO, setting yourself up, setting it to split, and then you basically hit a button called MR. If you touch it once, it will display what memory you're going to be writing into. And if you hold it down, it actually stores that information that you created in the VFO into that memory location. None of the Chinese radios tend to follow the same rule, but of the Japanese-created radios and of even some of the American ones, that's the basic methodology. Where you have to go layer by layer really depends upon how many buttons you've got. If you've got a lot of buttons on the radio, you're going to diminish that a little bit. Let me let it drop. If, like the 857, where there's basically 3 buttons on the front and a knob and a couple buttons on the side, then you're going to have to go dig a little deeper to get to other kinds of functions. But of the Japanese radios, they basically, even if you've got limited number of knobs, they'll give you one menu that you'll scroll through to find the memory write function, and the way it operates is exactly the same. Japanese manuals are not as bad as you claim them to be. People's understanding of the methodology of how to do something logically is somewhat lacking in a lot of people's cases, not in others. If you're familiar with using your computer, it becomes a rather easy task. Chinese have kind of ruined that game a bit, and there you need those cheat sheets because even though they printed it, in Chinglish, which doesn't quite make sense. We used to call it Jinglish when it came to the Japanese, but they learned rather quickly. I mean, when Trio became Kenwood, and it became marketed as Kenwood in this country, it was a lot better than it was as it was written for Trio, because what a lot of these companies did is they actually have their R&D departments in good old Silicon Valley. The same thing is true of Sony and and Kenwood and Gaysu, was that they got their engineers here doing the human part and the engineers in Japan doing the electronic part. So it's a mixed world, Dick. KTRW, K to the J.
Okay, if I understand what you're saying, Eric, if I learn the programming of a modern-day Kenwood, Gaysu, or ICOM, the big three, that there was a strong carryover between those brands, that once I learn those techniques, there's only minor differences between the other brands. However, even if I did learn those techniques on the big three, and then I pick up a modern-day Chinese radio, Luoxon is the way I pronounce it, Baofeng, I know there's no way of pronouncing it, I have the impression that their programming technique from the front panel is considerably different, and a number of people were forced to use the programming cable, and you had to choose the right programming cable with the right chip in order to be compatible with your radio and your particular computer, and then by way of the computer screen, it's a little bit easier. But if you want to program it from the front panel, I have the impression that those Chinese radios are a considerable break from the methodology of the big three. Is that approximately the way you see it? And by the way, if I do learn the programming of Luoxon, does it carry over to Baofeng? And Luoxon and Magfa, Baofeng, by way of the fact that these radios are being manufactured in such large numbers for commercial services, and as such, large volumes are being made, that's the good news. They're very inexpensive, that's the good news. But how much carryover is there between each of those brands and each of the individual model numbers? I have reason to believe that if I learned how to program one of those model numbers, there could be a fair amount of difference to another model number because it was intended for a different commercial service. And who makes the good cheat sheets for those, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, you are precisely right, sir. Although the Chinese are now beginning to learn, because the other folks, like a number of American companies that are marketing their products, that are beginning to demand, you know, a certain methodology. But do understand that they're designing radios for commercial service, and the ham market is just a secondary thing. Whereas that in the commercial world, you are not allowed to program the radio. The radio provider or the company that is providing the radio services for you are doing that, and it's pretty mandatory in today's world that you just simply plug your computer in, fill out the Excel spreadsheet of what you need, and load it. That's the way that it's going. But as some of these companies are learning about amateur radio, because don't forget, in that country, amateur radio was a very, 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 very tiny group of people in the beginning. As the country became more socialized, there are now more Chinese hands, and the amateur methodology was based upon their method of communication. As in Japanese, it's katakana, hiragana. There's a flow as to the meaning of the words, because these words are basically not words that we think of them, they're sounds. And it follows that kind of logic. But as the American distributors are ordering more and more products to be used in our particular market, with the front panel, that's beginning to change. Let me lay a drop. Not only is it beginning to change, but they're seeing this large amateur market that's worldwide, and the world hams are kind of used to the big three. So the fact that they're cheap got them there in the first place, but now it's being demanded that they begin to follow logic that follows English. So, and as your question goes between a Baofeng and a Baofeng and a this and a that, they're all different. Even between models, they're different. But the one thing that's common between all of them is the ability to talk to the radio serially, work from a spreadsheet that's got columns that say frequency, PL, shift, blah, 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 so on and so forth. That is the one common element. That's the saving grace for the hams who've got the first generation and the second generation of Chinese radio. As we come now to the more modern stuff that's being created, and some of it's not available here yet, they're beginning to actually go by what you would call the big three in terms of the logic of how you do something, which is really more based on language than anything else. K2RIW, K2JI.
You said some very interesting things there, Eric. Are you telling me that you have reason to believe that good news is on the way, that within the same approximate price range of the Baofeng and Roxong, you know, $30, $40, $50 radios, which cover an awful lot of VHF and UHF frequency region, that you know of model numbers that are in the pipeline, eventually coming to us, which are closer to the programming techniques of the big three? And while we're at it, are they also going to have this FCC mandated 2.5 kc of deviation instead of the 4.5 or 5 kc of deviation that we have up till now been using on our local repeaters? So give me some words on that. Sounds to me like you've either had some of your staff go to China recently, or you've been there recently and you've seen some of this equipment that's in the pipeline to us. Tell us a little bit about that. And how long do we have to wait? How expensive will it be? And how much better is it going to be, Eric? Sounds like we ain't heard the end of the story yet. Good electronics is heading for us. And our hard-earned money is about to go to another place. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, I got this Japanese communication magazine. It's written in Japanese. I can deal with a little bit of it, but the real good questions, the real good articles, I give to my son to translate for me. And actually, some of it is available online and you can use to Google Translate, and it does a lousy job of it, but you get the concept. But you got to remember that the thing that's driving them, by the way, some of these companies come and go from what I gather. The thing that is driving them is the commercial world, and the commercial world, again, requires that you can't program it from the front panel. So, things like the UV5R, they're never going to change that. That's already, you know, that's sort of like locked in stone as far as how that particular radio operates. They're not going to redevelop the software for it. If they'll do anything, they'll just make little improvements here and there. It's a big selling device for them. Whereas that I've seen UV5Rs that are designed purely commercial, and you can't do nothing from the front panel. You got the buttons there, but you can push them all you want until you're blue in the face. They have a couple of other problems. First of all, the 2.5 kc is all that you can manufacture for the United States and for most of Europe. So, you know, 2.5 kc deviation is not the mandate, it is the date. The date to change has long since passed, so that's the way they manufacture. If they're looking to operate in the amateur market, they could put the wider filters in there and make us hands happy, and there are a couple of companies that I'm aware of that are starting to do just that, where they're a separate line. Take an example of a company called Communication Systems Corporation.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
What'd you miss?
We missed about the last 30 seconds, and I'm glad to see that the Eastern Repeater has come back. Go ahead, you, Eric.
So, a company like CSC, where everybody's got either CSC 700s or CS750, which are the DMR radios, that's being driven by an American company in California, and as they develop, as they improve their software, as their software, which began as a commercial piece of software, moves in this way into the amateur market, we can follow the changes. We download the firmware updates every time they make a change. Radio has gotten better and better, and they still haven't gotten to the full data entry yet, but that's coming. So, the world learns, especially when there's a market to be tapped. The translation of communication from, say, English or from the U.S. to the Chinese manufacturers still rather poor, but as more and more of these other companies come in and say, we want this radio for this market, this is what what it has to have. That's happening. It's just going to take a long time, because once people get into a mode of operating, meaning that I've written the basic firmware for this radio, I'm not going to start from scratch and do it again. So as they develop the new product with these requirements set forth, as they begin to develop the software for that, and of course they will take what they've learned from the previous generations of radio and carry that across, and then figure out how to make the user interface so that makes sense to somebody other than them. And that's going to be a learning experience, and that's going to be painful until it gets to a point where it's really good. So, RIWK2J. Oh, the other thing that I was saying is that as far as bandwidth goes, 2.5 KC is the rule, and if they want to enter the amateur market gracefully, then the 15 kilohertz is going to come with that.
And when you talk about 15 kilohertz, you're talking about the total bandwidth of the IF strip, where the actual FM modulation on an amateur radio intended for a normal repeater service, I think is close to plus and minus 4.5 or plus or minus 5 KC of peak deviation. Is that true, Eric? Is that what you would see on your service monitor, your IFR? Over to you, Eric, KQLIW.
Yeah, you're going for plus or minus 5. Actually, plus or minus 4.5, you want to be realistic. But if we go back to the 70s and the 80s, we were doing plus or minus 15.
Yes, I remember those Motorola taxi rigs, taxi cab rigs, which were mostly with tubes. I think purely with tubes. They went south.
The G-line.
What was that again?
Motorola had the G-line. G is in George.
Yeah, some of these were fairly bulky packages that almost looked like a Cape Cod house. They had a sloping roof to it, and it took up a couple of cubic feet. That probably was before your time. Is that true, Eric?
Don't forget the only mobile radios had dynamos in it. It had room for them. And actually, one chassis was the receiver, and the other chassis was the transmitter, and the chassis in the middle was the power supply.
Yes, the Motorola ADT.
And there was a company in New Jersey selling those things used for a very nice price. What was again, Eric?
Gregory Electronics.
Yeah, good old Gregory. And do they still exist? And they must have made a fortune in those days reselling those pieces of equipment. Give us a couple of words on Gregory, and how many times did you go to, what city was that in New Jersey where they were located? Over to you, Eric.
No, I'm trying to think. It was either, they were either in Hackensack or Hohokus, I forget. No, I mixed that up between Mendelssohn. Yeah, where Mendelssohn hung out. It was like a warehouse. You would go through there and go through hundreds of radios and pick the one that you wanted. They were all taxicab radios and police radios. And they made the transition from two solid state when they went to Micros and Motrax and Mitrax. Had all these glut of tube radios. I even think one of my first radios was an RCA CMC-T30 with a dynamotor and two E26s in the output.
So now, to repeat what you've given us in the last few minutes, Eric, I had the impression that whichever of the big three radios, Yaesu, Kenwood, Icom, that you owned in the dark ages of 15 years ago, you cut your teeth on those days when they had hopefully a more complete, easier to understand owner's manual. You learned the programming techniques at that time, and therefore there's only minor variations with the more modern equipment. And therefore, the fact that the modern equipment with its owner's manual, which is quite scarce on information, that has not been a disadvantage to you because you already knew the techniques. And if you were cutting your teeth on one of these modern-day rigs today with the modern-day skimpier, more Spartan manual, I think you're saying you would have to have quite a few conversations with your buddy to get over the rough spots. I'm making some reasonable guesses on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, KQLIW in the tech net.
Please, Eric.
I think, well, it's never been a problem for me, okay? You got to understand that the RF guys do the RF part. The IT guys, or the computer guys, as we call them today, did their part. And they started out by doing it the computer way. And that quickly went past until they realized that non-computer people had to use it. Even to this day, I've got a 7000. The book is fine. There's a list of all the functions. There's even a flowchart of the list of all the functions. It's just a matter of how it's presented on the page. The information's there. And if you're a fairly logical person, you shouldn't have any difficulty with it. Hidden menus are hidden simply because there ain't enough buttons. So how you get to it, either by holding a button down or by pushing a button twice, you need some clues about that. If you're a gutsy kind of person, you don't mind pushing buttons, you'll discover some of them. But I haven't found a manual that doesn't have the information of Big Three. Of the Chinese, the first thing you want to do is take the manual and throw it in the fireplace. So, or how they communicate as a big deal. I can go back to when Sony was first making VCRs. This is before Betamax and VHS. They were real half-inch machines. And at first, they wrote it in Chinese. But then they discovered that the U.S. was their market. They set up their center in San Jose, where they actually did a lot of their research and engineering. And us American guys actually wrote the manual. And you could understand it perfectly.
DPZ, you get a chance? Basics DPZ, if I have a chance.
Off John, Rich, and Hal all want a chance. I'll choose one because he always disappears. K6DPZ, before you disappear on us, go ahead with your information on how to straighten this all out, Hal.
First thing, I wanted to wait for the beep. Okay, well, let me explain. Years ago, when there was a lot of FM equipment available for the ham market, a lot of stuff was commercial surplus radio equipment, like from Motorola, GE, and RCA. And these radios were used in public safety and a lot of other places. So there were some very good manuals written because the shops had to maintain this equipment. And a lot of the technicians didn't really have a lot of the knowledge. They may have the FCC licenses, but they didn't have a lot of the knowledge that was keeping these old radios going. So years ago, it was easy when you got an old radio to go get a manual. You read the theory of the manual. The schematics were very good. They gave you breakdowns on the stage gain measurements, signal levels, and everything. Which, you know, I used to work with Motorola's back to 5Vs and 30Ds, because I've been in this for many years. But today, when I'm involved with ICOM, Yasu, Kenwood, yes, they give you service manuals. The problem is they give you enough to get you in trouble. They don't give enough information, whereas a really good stage gain measurements and a lot of different voltage points, or even points where you can go in with a scope and look at some of your patterns coming out of the processor and so on and so forth, which makes it hard. That's why what I've done over the years is, hold on one second.
Break in there for a second.
To work on, after we get it repaired, we go and take all our notes and put it in a manual as far as voltage levels, stage gain measurements, and all of this helps out in, on another set when it comes in. We could knock the other set out in one-fifth the time. And then another trick is you turn the parameters as low as possible where the thing is still working. Let's say you have a transmitter, and you got a certain amount of power output on the transmitter with this multiplier chain and everything else. Take the first coil you have in that transmitter, turn it as far down as you can with the lowest amount of drive to still maintain the power output. Then take the measurements, be it RF voltage, peak-to-peak voltage, and so on the stages. So that would be the minimum amount of signal levels needed to make the thing put out. Those are my comments. RK2LIW, Keep 6 Dirty Purple Zombies.
Let me take a fifth second.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, well, Hal's information is very good, except that it's not on subject. The subject here is operations manual for the user, not the maintenance manual. We're not talking about that. The maintenance manual, by the way, if you look at today's modern stuff, I just got from Mr. Druckmann 6 triple-bound, big fat binders, all about the Master 5 repeater. And basically, the way that thing is set up is the way it's going now, is that they give you all the parameters, all the measurements, and all the IT stuff that you need, including the routers and the things that are associated with it. And they're basically telling you, if this board is bad, send it back to the factory, because it's become so complex in terms of that we don't use modern-day components like mixers and oscillators and stuff like that, where it's all basically built around something called an OMAP chip these days, which is a microprocessor with a DSP built into the same package. So all the RF generation, all that kind of stuff is not done the traditional way anymore. So a lot of service people just don't have the facilities to even locate where a problem is. It's more like when your new Dell computer goes bad and you know that the bridge chip fried. Now, how do you fix that? Where's the schematic? Where's the information? Or how do you even know that it's the bridge chip? Or a simple microprocessor. How do you know whether the microprocessor is functioning properly or something else in the loop is bad? Because everything's a loop, and anything in the loop can go bad, and you're going to have a fun time without the proper test gear to do it with the P2RWK junior.
Yeah, before I go over to John, I'm going to give you a couple of words on that, on what Eric just said. There was quite a few pieces of equipment, say for instance a regulated power supply, and if it's a pretty fancy power supply with a reference voltage and a plus 15 output and a minus 15 output and a plus 5 output, and all of these are interrelated into one great big almost phase-lock loop, phase-lock loop looking for a particular voltage of output, and when something goes wrong, you get quite confused because every single voltage measurement you make is the wrong voltage, and therefore you're led to believe you've had five failures at once. In reality, it may be just the reference voltage that went down, and therefore all other voltages go crazy. And so you've been down that road a few times, boy, can you get sucked up, if you know what I mean. I remember I volunteered once to fix a particular piece of electronics for a person where all of the IF stages were low in gain. And it took me a long time to find out that the reference voltage had the 6.0 volt, or reference Zener diode, had gone sour. It was only putting out like 4 volts. Therefore, all voltages on all stages of the radio were low. Therefore, all gains were low. And it sent me into quite a loop. And therefore, let me drop. One of the hard rules I have set for myself, whenever I do a piece of service on a transmitter or receiver, the very first thing I do is to measure all of the power supply voltages and reference voltages before proceeding. Because if they're not right, everything else is going to be wrong. And it can send you into one hell of a do loop. Now, John, I wonder if anybody signed into the Echo link with you and gave you some more information on the subject on the table right now. And to repeat for these people who may have tuned in, it was RDKD2HEG who is asking us, where in the world do you find the information as a newbie? He's a person who's in the ham radio business for a very brief period of time, and with his brand new FT897D, to find out all the hidden pieces of information as to how to really program with that particular rig, where you don't have prior history to back you up. Where do you find the information? Darn good question, and we're slowly approaching that. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
I think you passed me up. And here we go.
No, Dick. Rich, K2UPS has a comment on the subject.
Yeah, go ahead with UPS. Maybe he's on frequency, in other words. K2UPS, first of all, you're probably mobile. For the fun of us, for the pleasure of Rich, please tell us where you are and how you cut your teeth on these modern-day radios and learn how to program them. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, K2LIW in the TechNet.
UPS, Mobile, good evening, Dick in the net. I'm mobile right now in Pennsylvania, near where I-79 and I-70 is, southwest Pennsylvania, heading back to New York. I agree with Eric, and I disagree with what you were saying, that the information is not there. I have an old Collins S-line receiver. The operating manual for that is all of, I think, maybe 4, possibly 6 pages long. I have many new HTs and HF radios where the owner's manuals are over 100 or more pages long. The information is there in the manual. However, it's not necessarily very intuitive to the way that we're used to learning it. If you're going to take a brand new radio, HF radio, out of the box today and say, manual, I don't need no stinking manual, and try to figure the radio out, you're going to be in a world of hurt. You really need to sit down with the manual, with the radio on, hooked up to a dummy load, and go through it starting with page one, and go through the entire manual, maybe two or three times. Learn what each function is. The information is there. You just have to follow it in the order that they're telling you. If you're going to kind of hunt and peck and jump from chapter two to chapter five to chapter seven, I think you're going to have a problem. A new ham could also definitely help with an Elmer or another ham, maybe helping him learn some of the basics in there. But the radios today come with a wealth of information, almost too much information. And people look at the big manual and they just put it down and then they just try to use the basic features and never really learn the radio. But if you sit down, go through it, starting with chapter one, and learn what you need and what you don't, it's not as bad as you're making it seem, in my opinion, at least with the big three. The Chinese radio is another story altogether. I don't even want to get into those.
Telling useful information now, Rich. But let me ask you this question. Assume I got my ham radio license 2 weeks ago. I just had delivered from one of the mail order houses, something like
all the different functions that you can have. If you go through it page by page, the first one will tell you about receiving. The next one will tell you about transmitting. The next one will tell you about how to put tones on. The next page, etc. That goes exactly with what Rich is saying.
Okay, good information, Eric, and I thank you. And Rich, N2EO, how have you solved the problem? You've been in radio for a whole lot of years, and therefore you were there during the development of all these radios and all these manuals, and therefore you got it slowly and continuously. Picture a guy getting into the license very, very recently and seeing one of these radios brand new. I mean, somewhat similar to if you have lived with computers for the last 40 years, so to speak, and now you took a modern-day computer where the thing in your hand has got a hell of a lot more capability than the computer that was on the Apollo Command Service Module that got Armstrong to the moon. I mean, that was very primitive by modern-day standards. So you look at a modern-day computer and you'd say, how in the world did they create this thing? Step by step is the answer. So how did you solve the problem, and how would you solve the problem today, Rich? N2EO, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, good evening, N2EO. Well, a number of things. First off, there's a book out there. For every radio on the market, close to it, put out by a company called Nifty, N-I-F-T-Y. AESHRO, they have the books, and if they don't have it for your radio, they will get it to you. It's a small book. It takes the Jinglish and turns it into English, and it's an abridged manual. It's kind of like, I know I'm really dating myself, but if you went to high school in the 60s or 70s, and you got up to the last day before a report was due on Hamlet or something like that, you went out and you bought a Monarch manual or a Cliff Notes, and you read that overnight, you wrote the report. It didn't give you everything, but it gave you enough to get the report done. Same thing with the Nifty manuals. Also, King, W2KJI at KJI Electronics, he stocks some of them, or he can get it for you. Let me get a reset. Okay, also, I think it depends on the radio, the brand. This radio I'm on is a Icon ID880, and I find it very, very difficult to program. It's a FM and T-Star radio. I solved the problem. I cheated. I bought a program made by a company called RT Systems. I spoke to AI. He said, don't forget about the ICOM program. The RT systems is better. I bought it. It works fantastically. On the other hand, I have a Kenwood PS590 HF. I didn't even read the book, and I figured out most of the functions. It's just more better. It's much more easily laid out. Back to you, Dick and Toledo.
Some more darn good information. I thank you, Rich. I'm not sure whether or not Augie is on frequency, KD2HEG. If he is, I'm going to ask him to make a transmission where he might require some fills on some of the things that we've said so far. And even if he's not there, for everyone's information, I'll tell you that all of the TechNets for the last 10 years are recorded. You go to Mike Perry's website, KC2NJI. You get to that website by going to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateur radio, no punctuation, and there's a double R in between those two words. Amateurradio.tangovictor. And you choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and the right hour. And they're in 1 hour reels, and you can play back the TechNet, all of the past TechNets. Each brand new TechNet takes about 2, 3, 4 days before it appears, but they all do eventually appear. Another website is Mike Number Two. It's K2MJM, K1MJM. He's got a website night, which is LimarTechNet.com. It has other pieces of information that are very helpful for people who use TechNet. Even if Augie is not available right now, and if he needs a fill, he will be able to play back all of those words that we gave each other over the last three quarters of an hour. Let's see if Augie is there. Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Echo Golf, K2LAW. Go ahead, Augie. And I've never talked to him over the air. I just had a letter from Augie, a very nicely composed letter. So possibly he doesn't have the right equipment yet to talk to us directly. Okay, one last call. When it comes to hints and kinks for modern-day radio, learning how to program the darn thing and getting past the language barriers and the technical barriers, anybody else want to give us any last words before we go over to the next subject, give me your call letters on that subject right now. K2LAW in the TechNet. Okay.
QNW, could you please give me the website of the recorded past programs? I just recently came in here courtesy of I'm down in South Carolina. Thank you very much.
Very fine. All the last 10 years of TechNet are recorded with a couple of interruptions. 98% of it's all there, and that is on the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tv. That's what I mean by Tango Victor. So the real website is www.amateurradio, all run together, no punctuation, amateurradio.tv, .tangovictor, so to speak. You go to that website and you'll find 10 years. You'll find, I don't know the exact number, but it's probably close to 1,500 hours of TechNet, all recorded through the very enthusiastic work all these years through Mike Number One, Mike Perry, KC2NJI. These guys are doing it as a labor of love. I can remember a couple of times somebody called me up and assumed that I was tape recording the 4 hours of every TechNet week after week. People have some time called me up and said, can you make me a copy of the tape of TechNet number so-and-so? The answer is no. I don't record them. You're hearing it live as it happens. Okay, I think we've gone through that subject pretty well for tonight. It's a darn good subject. If anybody wants to bring it up again next week, don't worry about it. It's a darn good subject because I'm the one who has a fair amount of trouble. I haven't learned all of these programming tricks. I'm not that much of a computer maven. I claim to be an RF maven, but I'm not a computer maven. Another subject that we're going to discuss tonight, a darn good one, is by Roger, K2JAS. If Roger is available, I'm going to have him express the question, but he gave it to me a little bit earlier. I've been doing some thinking.
Dick, he's on Echo Link, by the way.
JAS is on Echo Link? Okay. So we have to give a little bit of extra delay because he's down in Florida. Roger's down in Florida, but Roger, you go ahead and express the problem. The question, it's a darn good question, which is going to eventually give us a lot of information, if I understand your question correctly. And we, if we go through a thorough enough decision, discussion of it, you're going to learn an awful lot about transmission lines, wires, and antennas. It's all tied together. K2JAS, go right ahead, Roger. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick, and my friend Chuck Sherwin, W4QNW, who's just joined us in Bluffton, South Carolina. The question is as follows, and it's something that has been puzzling me. If you start out with a battery, let's say a big 1.5 volt battery, and you attach two wires, so one to each terminal, but do not connect the wires to each other. So now you just have a DC source and two wires, and if in one of those wires you insert an ammeter, you will notice quite naturally that there is no current flowing in that wire. Now, disconnect the battery and attach a signal generator of sorts that goes way, way down into the audio frequency, and keep increasing the frequency of that signal generator. So now what we're dealing with is AC, and you will notice that when you look at the ammeter, there is no current flowing in that circuit because it's an open-ended circuit. But if you get that signal generator, let me drop it a second. Okay, if you get that signal generator to go up into the RF range, eventually you're going to start to see a current flowing in the ammeter, even though the wires that are attached to that generator are not connected to anything. So there's no load. And there never has been a load. And all of a sudden, the wires become a multiple of some frequency or whatever, and you have current flowing in an open circuit. And I know what we're talking about now is an antenna. And I'm asking, very simply, how does that work? How are you generating a current in an open circuit? Have I asked the question correctly, Dick? Back to you, K2JAS, Portable 4, Port St. Lucie, Florida.
Perfect, Roger. I get the picture. And it's a darn good question because it illuminates quite a few things at once. Now, I'm going to backtrack a little bit. You guys have heard me say time and time again that whenever you're building an antenna where you want to transmit a signal, your highest priority is to make the antenna radiating system. By system, I mean the thing you call the antenna, the thing you call ballon if there is one at the antenna, the thing you call transmission line, the thing you call the tank circuit, the final tuning stage of your transmitter, and the actual final tube or final transistor of the transistor of the transmitter. That total radiating system must hit resonance if you want any reasonable efficiency in radiating a signal. Resonance is the magic. An antenna that's not resonant, with rare exception, is going to give you extremely poor performance, like not even 1% radiated signal compared to what it could be there if it was resonant. So resonance is the magic. Let me drop. So as in your experiment, as you raise the frequency of that signal generator to a high enough frequency so that the length of wire on at least one side operating against the case of the transmitter, the signal generator, as if it is a counterpoise. By that I mean you have to push against something. You've heard me say quite often that Arnold Schwarzenegger, in my example, is floating freely in the cargo hold of the space shuttle. He's a 200-pound man, and he's holding onto a 200-pound barbell. And he pushes the barbell 1 meter per second to the north. His body will move in reaction 1 meter per second to the south. That's Newton's third law, action and reaction. It happens with mechanics, statics and dynamics of mechanics. It also happens with electronics. When you're pouring current into an antenna, you have to pour current starting from some point into some point. In other words, what you call a signal generator really is an electronic pump. It's a cyclic electronic pump. Let me drop it. That signal generator, in the case of a thoroughly balanced dipole being fed with twin lead, for instance, your signal generator, which could be mounted right in the center of that dipole, it is sucking electrons on one half cycle. It's sucking electrons out of the left-hand side of the dipole and pushing them into the right-hand side of the dipole. And at the next half cycle, it does the opposite. So you have to take the charge from some place and deposit it to some other place in order to make current flow in a cyclic manner in a thing that we call antenna. Once that antenna is resonant, it now has a lot of cycling energy inside of that piece of wire of the antenna, and that wire, almost every antenna will have something called Q. That really means it's got a resonant frequency and a certain bandwidth of that resonant frequency. One of the many definitions of Q is center frequency divided by bandwidth. So if the antenna is operating at 1 megacycle, and if it has a bandwidth, it's operating at 100 megacycles, and it's got a bandwidth of 1 megacycle, I divide the 100 by the 1, I get a Q of 100. That means that even though I'm putting, let's put a number, I'm putting 50 volts onto the antenna, somewhere in that antenna, because of the resonance, the voltage will be 100 times higher. There'll be 5,000 volts somewhere, even though you've only applied 50. And you're applying 1 ampere of current. Somewhere there's going to be 100 amperes of current flowing if the antenna has a Q of 100. So because the antenna is a resonant circuit, it has a voltage multiplication problem, a current multiplication problem, I shouldn't say problem, characteristic, and that's part of what's required to get efficient radiation. Let me drop it. And now I'm going to do it a little bit backwards from the way Roger was doing it. Roger was, in his example, starting off at DC and slowly increasing in frequency, and all of a sudden the circuit comes alive, AC current starts flowing, the antenna, the piece of wire becomes resonant, and it starts radiating. And up until then, almost nothing seems to be happening. Let me start off at the resonant frequency. I've designed this antenna. I'm feeding it, it's a 100 megacycle resonant dipole, we'll say, and I'm feeding 100 megacycles into it, maybe by twin lead, or maybe I've made a miniature transmitter that's mounted right at the center of the dipole, between the two halves. And that's the way amateurs used to do it in the old days. I'll get into that later. So I'm now at resonance. At resonance, the piece of wire, if it's in free space and it's a reasonably small diameter wire, presents an impedance very close to 73 ohms. It acts like a 73 ohm resistor as far as the signal generator is concerned. You could be running 73 volts out of the signal generator, and you will see a current of roughly 1 ampere when 73 volts is coming out of the signal generator into that dipole at the resonant frequency. But now let's start going down in frequency. I'm doing Roger's experiment, but I'm doing it in reverse. You're going to see what happens. Let me drop this. And it turns out two very intelligent guys, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, and I think they worked for Bell Laboratories at the time. We can look that up in every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. In Chapter 4, you will find the Brown and Woodward curves. What are these? They did an experiment with monopoles, which is half of a dipole. Every dipole is a pair of monopoles back to back. So they started off with a large sheet of metal and a piece of wire at right angles to that sheet of metal, and by changing the length of the wire and the diameter of the wire and sweeping it in frequency, they literally did Roger's experiment. Roger's experiment was using a ammeter. They went one step beyond that. Their so-called ammeter really was a little bit more sophisticated. It's called a slotted line. But the slotted line is measuring impedance, or measuring standing wave ratio. And once you know how much signal is coming out of your signal generator, and what is the standing wave ratio of the load, measured by way of that slotted line, It's the Cadillac version of an ammeter. You know exactly how many amps is flowing everywhere on that line and in the antenna itself. So by way of a slotted line, a slide rule, which is the computing device of that day, and a frequency meter and a wide-ranging signal generator, what Mr. Brown and Woodward did